Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst David McMichael, who examines allegations that the FBI covered up significant warnings it received prior to the September 11th terrorist attacks on New York and Washington. Winona Howder, director of Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project, who summarizes the latest developments in the investigation into Enron's corporate collapse and political scandal. And Dr. Aliyah Awad, director of Mental Health Services in the Palestinian Territories, who discusses the challenges he and his colleagues face in dealing with unrelenting conflict and the trauma endured by an exhausted civilian population. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Was slain Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl onto a major intelligence scandal when he was kidnapped in late January and later murdered by Islamic militants in Pakistan? That is the speculation of the Times of India newspaper. They cite comments by Pakistan's President General Pervez Musharraf, who in early March observed that Pearl got, quote, over-involved. Some Pakistani journalists feel that Pearl may have established links between Islamic militants and Pakistan's Inter-Service Intelligence Agency, or ISI. A columnist for a Karachi daily newspaper noted, "Why was Pearl the only one picked up?" There was an earlier report by the Pakistani magazine The Herald about ISI links to extremist groups. After the story was published, ISI agents quickly interrogated the reporters, seeking their sources. Other observers remind us that the prime suspect in the Pearl murder, Omar Sheikh, was never formally arrested for the brutal crime. Rather, he turned himself in to a trusted friend, Punjab Home Secretary Ejaz Shah, a retired member of the ISI. The Nation magazine reports that for the first time, a top U.S. official in Chile during the 1973 coup of General Augusto Pinochet could face prosecution for the murder of American citizen Charlie Horman, whose fate was depicted in the 1982 movie Missing. During this period, thousands of Chileans were murdered, disappeared, and tortured under the U.S.-supported Pinochet dictatorship. Horman was picked up by Chilean soldiers on September 17, 1973, and 2 days later he was secretly executed. Horman's killers were never brought to justice. Over the last year, Horman's widow Joyce has pushed for a full criminal probe of the crime. With the aid of Judge Juan Guzman Tapia, who in 2001 indicted General Pinochet on charges of kidnapping and murder, she has helped to launch a full-scale investigation. At the time that Horman was kidnapped by army troops, other Americans sympathetic to Socialist President Salvador Allende pleaded with U.S. Consul General Fred Perdy for protection. Perdy refused to help, telling the left-leaning Americans that they had nothing to fear from the U.S.-backed military coup. In early May, Perdy, now a resident of Santiago, was in Judge Guzman's court to give testimony in the probe. The former embassy counsel explained that he tried to help Americans, but Horman could not be saved because he did not seek the embassy's help. Judge Guzman objected to Purdy's explanation. He stated in court, "There are indications that you are involved in a cover-up and that you have not fully been forthcoming in this investigation." Guzman added that Purdy was now a criminal suspect in the probe. Guzman's investigation is also looking into the actions of 16 other U.S. officials, including then-U.S. Ambassador Nathaniel David and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. So far, the U.S. government has refused to cooperate with the investigation. From a distance, Lake Coeur d'Alene in northern Idaho appears pristine. It has dark blue waters that draw summer tourists, and the lake serves as the spiritual center of the Coeur d'Alene tribe that lives on a reservation near Plummer, Idaho. But there is trouble under the lake's surface. On the bottom are 72 million tons of toxic mining waste, the result of years of zinc mining 40 miles upstream. Now heavy metals such as cadmium and lead pose a real risk to the lake's fish and aquatic life, although the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says the polluted water is no threat to people swimming in the lake or drinking its water. According to E!, the environmental magazine, thousands of migrating trumpeter swans have died upstream after eating lead-tainted foliage. In the early 1990s, the Coeur d'Alene tribe went to federal court to force a cleanup of the toxic waste and won its first suit. Yet the EPA has taken a go-slow approach to toxic cleanup. Resort owners and local business interests vigorously objected when the lake was declared a federal Superfund site. After facing criticism, the EPA left the lake cleanup to state and local governments. But the Sierra Club and the tribe are now fighting for a full federal cleanup, including reforestation of areas heavily logged. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
Not long after the public learned the White House had received warnings prior to September 11th about possible hijackings and attacks being planned by Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network, there are new allegations about the inadequacies of the nation's intelligence agencies. Colleen Rowley, a Minneapolis FBI field agent, accuses officials at the Bureau's Washington headquarters of blocking an investigation into Zacharias Moussaoui, the man arrested in Minneapolis in August and believed to be in training as the 20th hijacker. Rowley, a 21-year veteran of the FBI, stated in the explosive classified memo sent to FBI Director Robert S. Mueller and leaked to the press that she believed certain facts have up to now been omitted, downplayed, glossed over, and/or mischaracterized in an effort to avoid or minimize embarrassment on the part of the FBI and/or perhaps even for improper political reasons. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst David McMichael, who examines the performance of U.S. intelligence agencies in confronting terrorism and the allegations made by some conservative politicians that a lack of funding and the imposition of human rights standards hobbled these agencies' ability to protect the country.
Second-guessing in an affair like this is entirely appropriate because, I mean, that's another word for reviewing the situation and seeing what happened and where could we have been more diligent. So I've got nothing against so-called second-guessing. The other aspect of this is the questioning of patriotism and so forth. I think it's entirely out of bounds as the White House and certain elements in the administration have tried to do. No, there's nothing unpatriotic about investigating the situation. We took a hard hit, and it's time to look around and see what happened, and let's not have it happen again.
What about the question of resistance to some kind of blue ribbon panel coming in and taking a close, hopefully objective look at what happened?
I have a little problem with the blue ribbon investigation of any sort. I think as we go back through our recent history, it seems recent to me anyway, 40 years to the Kennedy assassination and the investigations that followed on that, the Warren Commission, the various post-Vietnam investigations, the Church Committee, the Pike Committee, at least the one that sticks most in my mind and in my craw, if you will, is the Iran-Contra investigations, most of which, are designed more to protect individuals than to, find the truth. I've never really been satisfied with that approach, and inevitably there will be an investigation. I think the White House definitely prefers to have it confined to the intelligence committees. I think that quite legitimately, Tom Daschle and others on the Democratic side would like to see the appointment of an independent commission, but, as I say, going back over the experience in my lifetime, I'm not overly optimistic that the truth or the whole truth will be done. As I examined this, over the last couple of weeks, it seemed to me relatively clear that the intelligence gathering, the foreign intelligence gathering, was pretty good. It seemed clear early on, and now is abundantly clear with the publication by Time magazine of this extraordinary letter by Colleen Rowley, one of the FBI special agents in the Minneapolis office, who roundly accuses headquarters of the FBI, the top management of the FBI, and her own boss, Robert Mueller, of almost unconscionable failures to act on very strong information that could, in her opinion, have possibly prevented one or more of these hijackings.
David McMichael, there are many who claim that the U.S. intelligence agencies have been hobbled, as they say, over the past decade or so by congressional restrictions on funding and the use of unsavory assets or agents. There were complaints that there were too many human rights restrictions on who the CIA and other intelligence agencies could use in tracking down vital information to the security of this country. How do you respond to those?
Well, I've seen and heard this before. I spent almost 4 years in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. And I kept having people come in my office complaining that we were being forced to fight the war with, quote-unquote, one hand behind our backs. And when you consider that in a country that was roughly, you know, twice the size of New Jersey, we dropped, more than twice the tonnage of bombs that we used in the whole of World War II, I found that hard to credit, you know? I respond to these current claims of hobbling and not being allowed to go forward. I find that totally unconvincing. I watched us in the 1980s, and of course that was part of the Iran-Contra, which caused an outcry. I watched us run what I think we could, quite correctly call a terrorist campaign against the country of Nicaragua, which killed at least 15,000 people, far more than died in the attacks of 9/11, by the way. I don't think anybody lost too much sleep over that. And the budget, yes, the budget was cut in the first year of the Clinton administration. But I also want to point out to you that the CIA budget was tripled between 1981 and 1992. So any cutback was from a pretty high level. No, I don't accept that, but I expect it. I expect it. Of course you're going to say, well, you didn't give us the resources. No, we didn't have enough budget. No, you were tying our hands by making us obey the law. So I don't, as they say, I find it hard to take that altogether seriously.
That was former CIA analyst David McMichael, who now serves as the director of the Association of National Security Alumni. Congress continues its investigation into the collapse of the Enron Corporation, while the White House does its best to block information requested, examining its connections with the failed energy company's executives. The U.S. Senate, controlled by the Democrats, recently voted to issue the White House subpoenas demanding documents that could shed light on the influence Enron had in the development of the Bush energy policy, its conduct during the California energy crisis, Enron's collapse, and the administration's appointment to various regulatory posts. Army Secretary Thomas White's possible involvement in market manipulation and price gouging during California's energy crisis, at a time when he served as vice chair of Enron's Energy Services Division, have prompted consumer groups to call for his resignation and a Justice Department probe. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Winona Howder, director of Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project, who summarizes the latest developments in the investigation into Enron's corporate collapse and political scandal.
Well, I think that Enron is an example of corporate and government corruptness when we see government officials cooperating with a corporation to help them make money. Last week, a Senate panel voted to issue subpoenas. The General Accounting Office had issued subpoenas in February. A little bit of information had come to light that basically the Bush administration has been stalling. Now, a memo has come to light that has further indicated that Army Secretary Thomas White's former Enron division was involved in market manipulation and price gouging during the California electricity crisis. And White, who was appointed by Bush to be Secretary of the Army, is the highest-ranking official who worked for Enron and then was appointed by the Bush administration. The Bush administration has had very, very close ties to Enron, and also the Republican Party has. So we have seen a very, very close relationship between key Republican members of Congress and supporters of the Bush administration. And rather than being really forthcoming and admitting that certain officials had relationships with Enron, the Bush administration is continuing to stonewall and not give the information that's being requested by Congress and by arms of Congress like the General Accounting Office. So it's a fairly outrageous situation.
What specifically is the Senate looking for in these subpoenas, and what kind of information is the White House preventing from going to the Senate and, of course, to the public about their involvement with Enron?
Well, the Senate panel is basically looking if any officials at Enron ask anyone at the White House for help before the Enron bankruptcy last December. And they want to see, there are many, many employees who could have received phone calls from Enron, many employees at the White House and in the Bush administration. And so we're talking about thousands of pages of documents. Now, we do know that some of the material that was disclosed last week showed that there were private meetings. For instance, in mid-April, Enron Chairman Kenneth Lay had a meeting with Cheney in which energy policy and the power crisis in California were discussed. And remember that Cheney also was the head of the Energy Policy Task Force. And a meeting was disclosed last year between Cheney and Enron, and that occurred on a PBS television documentary. So basically, it's to see if there was any illegal behavior going on between officials in the Bush administration and Enron.
Now, how far do you think the White House will take this fight to prevent Congress from getting a hold of these documents? Implicit in that stonewalling, as you put it, is that they have a lot to hide. Do you think that's the case?
Well, it seems like it, because they have made a much bigger deal of this than if they had just released documents if they didn't have something to hide. And one can only suspect that there were meetings or conversations that they don't want the public to be aware of, or they would release this document. It makes disclosure and the need for disclosure that much more important.
The Enron Corporation, before its collapse, poured lots of money into lobbying for deregulation across the country in our energy markets, and we saw the results in California, the disastrous results in California. Is there any move afoot now to roll back some of that deregulation to protect consumers?
You know, you would think after the debacle with Enron and the experience in California that our policymakers would be very nervous about deregulation. But instead, what we've seen with the energy bills that have passed the House and Senate is that there is further deregulation planned. There is language in both bills to repeal the Public Utility Holding Company Act that protects electricity consumers, and that if it had not been weakened recently, might have prevented the Enron debacle. So as far as we can see, the energy companies still intend to pursue deregulation, to lobby for deregulation, and to move it forward. And the unfortunate aspects of this whole debacle is that the U.S. media, Wall Street, government officials, they would like us to believe that this is a one bad apple, an unusual situation. But I'm afraid that what's going to happen is that we're going to see many Enrons in the future if we don't have major changes and reforms in a number of different areas. And it doesn't bode well when we see Congress passing an energy bill that furthers deregulation and is just absolutely irresponsible.
That was Winona Howder, Director of Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project. Contact Public Citizen by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. Israel's recent military offensive into major Palestinian cities in the West Bank were launched, Ariel Sharon's government said, to destroy the infrastructure of terrorism. But the siege of Yasser Arafat's headquarters, the destruction of the Jenin refugee camp and other Israeli strikes appear to have had little lasting effect on preventing a return of deadly suicide bombings in Israel. Since Israel withdrew its troops from Palestinian cities and towns in early May, there have been 5 suicide bombings, the latest being an attack on an outdoor cafe in Petah Tikva, which killed a baby girl, her grandmother, and wounded 40 others. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, a militant Palestinian group linked to Arafat's Fatah movement, claimed responsibility for the bombing, stating it was in retaliation for the Israeli assassination of 3 of their leaders. While the violence and insecurity suffered by Israeli citizens during the last 19 months of escalating conflict is widely reported in the U.S. press, less well known is the psychological impact of the daily indignities and bloodshed endured by the Palestinian civilian population, under occupation now for 35 years. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Elia Awad, Director of Mental Health Services in the Palestinian Territories with the Palestine Red Crescent Society. Dr. Awad, reached by phone at his home near Bethlehem, discusses the challenges he and his colleagues face in dealing with unrelenting conflict and trauma experienced by an exhausted Palestinian population.
Since the beginning of the Intifada, we started to work with the victims in different areas. First of all, I worked with children who were terrified because of bombing and shelling. So we have to work with them to deal with their fears. And also I work with the mothers who lost their houses because of the shelling and bombing of their houses. So, for example, in Beit Sahur, where I'm living right now, 500 houses were completely demolished, while in Beit Jala, 800 houses were demolished. So those families became refugees in their towns. And my job is to go there and work with the mothers and work with the children. The problem also is that at the beginning I asked my social workers to join the EMS, the emergency medical services, to go into the ambulances and keep going on into the clashes areas. And our job is to stay in the ambulance. And whenever we have a kid, small child who is wounded or really bleeding, our job is to stay in the ambulance and take care of that child. We are just giving comfort to this child, saying that we are with you, you will be all right, and we keep going on in the ambulance till we reach the hospital. Then the next job is to stay in the hospital and wait for the family to come. And usually when the family comes, they are in a really hysterical case. They are crying and shouting, and nobody in the hospital is taking care of them. So our job is to really wait with them, take care of them, and really be with them till the situation will be clear in terms of whether the child is really dead or is he wounded or what is happening. Other jobs that we have to do is really to move into field hospitals and work over there to receive those who are wounded or severely injured and stay with them till they got to the hospital. But when bombing and shelling start to be very severe, I asked all my social workers to move out from the field and really wait, go to the families where they have no houses, their property was destroyed, and work with them, telling them we are with you, and take care of their children. Additionally, the income is really deteriorating. 64% of the people of the nation are living below the poverty line, so people don't have money. And we have to take care of them. We also move to work with children through drawings to tell them if they can draw, and then we ask them to share with us their stories, what those drawings are saying. The problem here is that we don't have one event, one disaster, and that's it, and we have to deal with it. It's continuous every day. Every day we have surprises, and we are really overwhelmed. We are burnt out, and we don't know where to start, what to do.
In terms of hope for the future, certainly hopelessness is a real incendiary formula for self-destruction and destruction of people around you. Is there hope in the Palestinian population at large, and you yourself, that there can be peace, there can be a settlement, that a Palestinian state will come into being and people can again return to a normalcy and try and heal from this trauma of so many decades?
I think there is a majority in the Palestinian people, the innocent people who are not involved in anything, who would love to see peace, security for both nations, for the Palestinians and the Israelis. I myself believe that the Israelis should have a secure and really should live in peace and stability. But I can't believe that they can have it, have full peace, full security and stability while they are occupying another nation. They can't continue with this forever, confiscating their lands, humiliating them, and really asking for peace, security, and stability while they are inside the West Bank and Gaza with their tanks and with their F-16 and 15. The best solution is that to get out and leave the Palestinians to have a democratic society. Now, I can't imagine that the Palestinians can really have a state without democracy. I think they have to fight corruption. They have to work for democracy. And they have to start from the bottom, from the civil society. Lots of things have to be done here to heal the wounds. And I can't see any peace process going on without healing the wounds, the psychological wounds of the people. We have till now 1,521 who have been killed. We have 10,000 who are in Israeli jails. We have over 40,000 people who were physically injured. We have over 32,000 people who are handicapped because of what is happening. So I think we have to work together with the Israelis. We have to stretch our hands and work to heal the wounds of their nation, of their people, and our people, without tanks, without those who are killing themselves and killing the others. I don't know whether this is a dream, but I pray for God that people who love peace should get together and try to do something else. And I hope we can do it.
That was Dr. Elia Awad, Director of Mental Health Services in the Palestinian Territories. For more information, visit the Palestinian Red Crescent Society website at www.palestinercs.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.